morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Tinner and I are very pleased to have Judge Lawrence of the Southern District of Indiana sitting with us, help us with our caseload. Welcome. So our first case for argument, United States versus Pollack. Ms. Kernan?
May it please the court, my name is Megan Kiernan, and I, along with my co-counsel Jules Levinson, represent the appellant Charles Pollack, pursuant to a 7-Eleven license through the Bloom Legal Clinic at Northwestern University School of Law. This court should reverse and remand for three reasons. First, the district court made numerous mistakes at sentencing. Second, the jury was not properly instructed. And third, the government engaged in prosecutorial misconduct. For those reasons, we ask this court reverse and remand. Your Honors, I'd like to turn to sentencing first because the errors there were egregious. It's clear from the record that the district court wanted to punish Pollack severely, and it muddled the guidelines and it muddled the law in order to do so. The average sentence for a felon in possession conviction is 2 to 5 years. The average sentence for attempted witness tampering is 1 to 3. Pollack received 20. Now, Your Honors, I'd like to turn to the most serious error at sentencing, which was the imposition of the cross-reference. Now, there's a two-pronged test for applying a cross-reference. First, the conduct at issue, here the alleged sexual abuse, needs to be relevant conduct, and this is a threshold matter. Second, the gun needs to have facilitated the alleged sexual abuse. Now, what the district court did was it misinterpreted both of these prongs, it conflated them, it created an entirely separate and incorrect test. But even if it had applied the correct test, the cross-reference is still wrong as a matter of law. And here's why. The alleged abuse had nothing to do with a firearm. It didn't involve one. Pollack didn't have a gun on him. He didn't have a gun in the room. And as Bauer made clear, Pollack did not threaten a gun before or during the abuse.
Well, the abuse didn't end with the sexual act, did it? He held control of her for some period of time thereafter.
Yes, Your Honor, the abuse did end with the sexual act. First of all, Bauer explains that...
So he leaves her, and he goes to take a shower, and he says, if you move, I'm going to kill you. So the abuse is over at that point?
Your Honor, that's not sexual abuse. Bauer makes clear that the abuse ended. She then notes this change in circumstance that you pointed out, that Pollack calmed down, he became depressed, he went and took a shower, and then the threat, if it happened, happened after all of that. It can't possibly facilitate something that was already over. Now, I'd like to quickly then point out that the cross-reference is wrong both as a threshold matter, because the abuse is not relevant conduct, and because the gun did not facilitate it. Now, taking a step back, again, the average sentence for a felon in possession is 2 to 5 years, and part of why Pollack's sentence was so inordinately long is because of this erroneous application of the cross-reference, which is really a very serious error that the district court made. Now, moving on to another error that the district court made at sentencing, the the imposition of a 10-year consecutive sentence for attempted witness tampering. Now, Pollack sent a friendly, non-threatening letter to Clays asking him not to testify. Now, Pollack shouldn't have done this, and it was wrong, but it doesn't justify a 10-year consecutive sentence, especially in light of this court's prior cases. Most attempted witness tampering convictions, as I mentioned earlier, get between 1 and 3 years. Even the cases that get 3 years usually involve much more extreme conduct than we have here, such as death threats to the witness. And in cases where defendants actually receive 10, it's not attempted witness tampering, they've been successful. And those cases usually involve violence. One case in particular, the defendant split a witness's head open. This 10-year consecutive sentence is just completely dwarfs the average sentence. And it goes back to what I said earlier about the district court really looking to punish Pollack severely.
Well, was this argued to the judge, that it was an excessive sentence?
Your Honor, we challenge now that it is unreasonable both in its length.
That's not my question.
Your Honor, I don't believe that defense counsel below argued against the length and the consecutive nature of the witness tampering sentence. However, we argue now that it is both substantive, it's unreasonable both in its length and in its consecutive nature. And I'd like to also point out some of the procedural errors made by the court. Here the district court didn't really consider the 3553A factors, and had it, it would have been forced to discuss.
What do you mean it didn't really consider them?
Your Honor, it merely listed them. There was no actual analysis. It did exactly what this court said a district court can't do in Washington, in Lyons, in Garcia Oliveros. A district court needs to engage in some sort of greater analysis, and particularly when there are such serious sentencing disparities. That's one of the 3553A factors. And here the court didn't do that. Mm-hmm. Nor did it consider, as Section 3584 requires.
When you say disparities, I thought the guideline exceeded the sentence that was given here.
It did, Your Honor.
By a lot.
It did, Your Honor. But the guideline itself, the calculation, was so erroneous that it doesn't really mean anything that the sentence the district court gave is below the guideline. Everything the district court did to get to that range was incorrect. So the fact that there's it's not really a below guideline sentence. It's like saying it's below something that is already wrong. Moving on from sentencing to errors made at trial, unless Your Honors have any additional questioning or questions on sentencing. The district court also failed to instruct the jury that it needed to unanimously agree on the specific firearm possessed.
I didn't understand your discussion of specific firearm at all. What's that about? I don't understand the significance you attach to the caliber of the gun, whether it was a 45 or not. What difference does that make?
It makes two differences, Your Honor. First, it's important because the government needs to prove that Pollack possessed a specific firearm.
I don't know what that means, a specific firearm. He has to have possessed a firearm. What do you mean specific?
Your Honor, the indictment listed 9 specific guns. You know, a 45 caliber revolver, a 45 caliber semi-automatic pistol. The government needs to prove which one.
Why?
Because it's an element of Section 922G.
I don't understand. The gun, a gun, having a gun is an element. What difference does it make which gun? You have nine guns. Suppose you use not. You have nine guns and you use one of them to kill someone. What does it matter which gun you used?
Well, Your Honor, first, here...
No, you answer my question. What difference does it make? If some nut has multiple guns, uses one of them to kill someone, and we don't know which one it is, so what? He's going to get away with murder because you don't know which of his, multiple guns he used?
Your Honor, possession of a specific firearm?
Just tell me, what is the reason?
The reason,
what is your reason?
The reason here...
statutory text that requires such a stupid result, or what?
The reason here, Your Honor, is yes, the text requires this result.
And what text?
The text of Section 922G1. It requires this result. Possession of a specific firearm...
It says possesses a firearm. It doesn't say possesses the firearm.
Your Honor, it says possess any firearm.
Any firearm.
Here, the use of the word
any, of course, argues against you. Any suggests if you have a collection of guns, use one to commit a crime. You know, used any gun.
Your Honor, any is inclusive.
Oh, please. By the way, where do you get in your brief? You say things about statutory interpretation which strike me as nonsensical. What do you mean when you say all statutory construction begins with the plain language? What does that mean? What if it doesn't have plain language?
Your Honor, in this case, we have
no, answer my question. Why do you say that? Why do you say something like that?
Your Honor,
all statutory construction begins with the plain language. No, it doesn't begin with the plain language if there is no plain language. Second of all, it never begins with the language. It begins with the title of the statute. That's what orients you when you read the statute.
Your Honor, even if it begins with the title of the statute, that doesn't speak to the issue here.
You know, I've got a more fundamental problem. All of these arguments about count one are curious, but there's count two. He's convicted of count two, possession of ammunition by a felon. He gets a 120-month sentence for that. You raise no challenge to that here or below. So why do we even bother worrying about count one?
Your Honor, because
Pollock... Seems to make no difference at all. There's no challenge to the sentence either of count
Pollock
two.
Pollock is still harmed by his conviction based on an erroneous
his
jury instruction.
His conviction of count one, who cares? If there's count two, which carries the very same penalty.
Your Honor, it's important not to conflate harm from the guilty phase to harm from the sentencing phase.
Well, the sentence on count two is 120 months to be conserved concurrently with count one sentence.
Yes, but...
So as long as that count stands and that sentence stands, it doesn't matter what happens on count one.
The harm to Pollock is independent of the other charges and any possible resulting conviction.
How so? It's a concurrent sentence with a count you don't challenge.
Because due process requires a judge instruct on every element of a crime so that the jury be unanimous. Here, the district court did not make that instruction, and it deprived Pollock of his right to a unanimous jury verdict.
I understand what you're arguing about the count one, but count two still stands, and it's the very same penalty.
Your Honor, there is still harm from count one. There can be harm from independent convictions, even if other convictions stand. They're independent.
Well, what would the harm be?
From the first count, right. From the district court's instruction, that Pollock didn't, the district court's instruction deprived him of his right to a unanimous jury verdict.
I know, but you're not engaging with Judge Tinder's question. If he's stuck with 120 months regardless of count one, what difference do errors in count one make?
Because that would merit a new trial.
No, how could he get a new trial
when
it wouldn't affect the length of his imprisonment?
Because it affected the conviction. Because if
we could reverse count one, and Mr. Hartzler could say, well, that's fine. We'll just leave the sentence on count two.
Yes, Your Honor, but the instruction affected the conviction. The jury would not have...
It didn't affect count two, or you would have argued it, I would have thought.
Correct. We're not challenging count two. But Pollack would still have a right to be retried on count one.
Well, what would be the benefit to him of an acquittal on count one?
Because if we take it back to trial... And
what would the benefit to him be? Suppose he's acquitted on count one. How does he benefit?
A shorter sentence.
No, because he's cut the 121 months on count two. So how is a shorter sentence on count one going to help him?
Your Honor, I see I'm into my...
How is a shorter sentence on count one going to help him? That's Judge Tinder's question.
It would be possible that the district court could also reevaluate that sentence. I mean, we are arguing...
On what basis? Because you haven't challenged it below or here. It's nowhere in your brief.
Your Honor, we're arguing that the entire sentence is substantively unreasonable, and so are its parts.
Your argument was only as to count one and count three. You raised no argument as to count two.
No, Your Honor. We also argue that the entire 20-year sentence is... Now, not count two specifically. You're correct. But to say that the entire sentence is substantively unreasonable is also to say that its component parts are substantively unreasonable.
No, it isn't to say that at all.
We believe that it is, Your Honor. We believe each one of...
You have to challenge count two, don't you?
No, Your Honor. The entire sentence, the way the counts are run, are substantively unreasonable.
No.
Your Honors, I'd like to move briefly...
No, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honors. We ask you reverse and remand.
Thank you very much, Ms. Keegan. Ms. Kiernan. Mr. Hartzler?
Good morning. Joe Hartzler on behalf of the United States. I think it's tempting for us to argue the concurrent sentence doctrine and suggest that you could affirm this sentence without further consideration of count one, but I thought the problem was that the allegation is that there is a procedural error during the sentencing hearing, and since count one and count two are grouped, my assumption was that they're challenging the sentence on both of those counts. And the problem with the sentencing hearing is the facilitation of another offense only applies on count one. There's no argument that the cross-reference would apply to his possession of the ammunition. So I think that's how the concurrent sentencing doctrine is probably not going to apply. The same guideline applied to all three. In fact, all three accounts were grouped because instead of separately calculating a guideline for the witness tampering, they added the 2 points for obstruction of justice, came with the total sentencing calculation, which we believe was correct for reasons that were suggested, which is if you view rape as an act of sex as opposed to an act of violence, then yes, the argument is it was over at the time he mentioned the gun. But if you view rape as an act of violence intended to demean and dominate and intimidate the victim as occurred here, then the rape experience continues as it did here. And as Judge Tinder mentioned, he's even threatening her after the intercourse about takes her into the bathroom and tells her to sit there, and if she moves, he's going to kill her. So the question is that was his reference to having a .45 that he could use to kill the both of them, was that in connection with that violent act? Our argument is, of course, it was.
Yes, prior to that act, did that woman have any awareness of his possession of guns?
She clearly had some awareness of possession of guns because she had gone to his mother's house with him the month before, or in June, and collected the guns. I think the reason it didn't come up at sentencing as to what her knowledge was is that I don't believe she knew where the guns were. You may recall from the transcript that he dropped her off at church. He took the guns in his trunk to someplace else. So there was a direct question, I believe, at sentencing, either from the judge or the prosecutor, about what was your awareness or were you thinking about the guns that he had. And I believe she said no. I mean, I hope you'll double check that. So, yes, an argument can be made that she had an awareness of his guns, but she didn't know where they were. And I think the point is made that we have every reason to believe they were out in the trunk of that junk car some considerable distance. It was the quote-unquote 45 that he referenced in his comment to her during the abduction as being someplace hidden in the garage. And that's the instrumental weapon that facilitates this continuing abduction. Can I also mention that we, of course, would like to see this case not come back for resentencing. There's an argument that I missed, and therefore we have waived it. But if it's not rape, it's clearly unlawful restraint. And if you do the calculation under the unlawful restraint, under 2A4.1 as opposed to 2A3.1, it comes out the same. So there's a harmless error argument that we simply miss. And I mention it only because if this case were to go back for remanded on resentencing, that will be the argument on behalf of the government. So I would urge the court, you don't address that argument. Well, I understand, because the government didn't raise it, we missed it. If that doesn't happen, at least I would hope that we would get some resolution of the issue of whether or not this comment about the 45 satisfies the in connection with. That's the preliminary question. Under the cross-reference, the gun has to be used in connection with another offense. So let's put aside for a moment what the other offense is. Obviously here it was concluded it was a sexual assault. But I would hope that the court would at least address, does this satisfy the facilitation or in connection with? And on that point, there was argument today and in the brief about how we weigh this because there's no argument on relevant conduct. Well, any time that a crime is committed in connection with the possession of a gun, it's going to be relevant conduct. If you look through the whole 2K series in the guideline book, there are a number of instances where, like body armor, if you wear body armor in connection with another offense, you wouldn't expect the judge to conclude in sentencing, well, was the other offense relevant conduct? I mean, if the body armor is worn in connection with another offense, that's per se relevant conduct. The relevant conduct is really sort of red herring issue. If the question is, as indicated, by the way, in the commentary to the guidelines, if you look at the commentary to the guidelines, it defines in connection with to mean facilitated. And there's no issue of relevant conduct. The reason the relevant conduct issue came up, or has come up in the past, and I think if you look at the cases the defendants mentioned, they're all pre-2006 cases. In 2006, the Sentencing Commission amended the commentary to define in connection with. And before that, there was some question of what does this in connection with mean. There was some analysis as to whether or not it should be relevant conduct. My point is, of course, we didn't address that, and it's the argument is, well, if it's in connection with, it's per se relevant conduct.
Why did the government argue that the jury had to be unanimous about which gun was used?
I don't know. I think that it was odd because the guns were all always grouped. And in this case, in this court's original Bookmeyer decision, which the defendants point out, not the en banc Bookmeyer, but the direct appeal in Bookmeyer, the court has defined the unit of prosecution for and under 922G as being the simultaneous possession of weapons, so that we would only charge nine weapons in one count, whereas if there are several different transactions or several different acquisitions, it could be charged in separate counts. And that didn't happen here.
That's not my question. My question is, why does the jury have to agree? If you have a bunch of guns. No one is sure which one was used. Why do all the jurors have to agree on which one was used?
They wouldn't have to agree.
They wouldn't.
No.
But the government said that here.
I saw that.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe they were trying to eliminate an issue on appeal. How about that? I don't know why that argument was made. Yes. I mean, you saw how it developed. There was some question of whether or not the jurors had to conclude. Let me start again. There was some concern on the part of the prosecution, apparently, that the jury might feel it has to find all nine guns.
Uh-huh.
And so they wanted to, you know, wipe away that issue, erase that issue. And the judge said, well, you can take care of that in closing argument. They took care of it in closing argument by suggesting they'd be unanimous on one particular gun. Yes. My answer to you is I think that was unnecessary. It does seem odd in light of the law. To some extent, if this court were to conclude that the law was, if you make a radical change in the law, then arguably it's harmless error. I don't assume the court has any questions about the alleged misconduct during the trial. That's, I think, a minor issue. I hope I've addressed the questions about the sentencing, that the direct route, mm-hmm. the easiest route to affirmance is to conclude that rape is an act of violence, not an act of sex, and that it was a continuing process in which he was continuing to intimidate and dominate Kim Boyer until she was released. Therefore, the cross-reference appropriately applied. It appropriately applied to count one, count two, and those were the both determined to have the same guideline range. The judge applied 5G. Oh, I should mention the consecutive sentences. If you look under the 5G guidelines about multiple counts, it talks about imposing sentences consecutively to reach the total sentence. Well, here the guideline range was 30 years. He could have reached the total sentence, but he wanted that to be a 20-year sentence. Could have reached that by making a consecutive on count one and two. But those were both 922G offenses, and I think
But they're different possessions, aren't they? The guns are in one place, and the ammunition is in his sock drawer.
No question about it. Yeah, clearly. Well, one is in the house, and one's outside. Sure.
And none of the guns, the ammunition wouldn't fit in any of the guns possessed. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
It appears to fit an AK-47.
It was a high-powered rifle. Yes. Yes.
And there's some magazines for an AK-47 with the ammunition. Is that right?
You understand the record correctly? Yes. That's
and,
my understanding.
And the AK-47 was never found.
No high-powered rifle was ever found. Yeah. Why he had that ammunition, I can't explain.
Well, I do hope that the assistant that tried the case will read these briefs and read the transcript about what he said. He was off point in terms of which gun had been identified.
I apologize. I'm not following you.
Well, the assistant who made the argument, not you, I understand, was referring to this .45 as having been identified by Kales, I think it was, and he had not identified.
Correct.
So I hope he is aware of that. He's aware of what he did.
Oh, they're well aware of. Yes. Yes. They're well aware of the two prosecutors.
Right.
Yes. They both reviewed the brief and are well aware of the mistake they made. I could apologize to the court on their behalf or on behalf of the government. It was a mistake. Oh, by the way, on that, though, if you look at the exhibit list, I think you'll maybe understand. If you look at the exhibit list, you'll see that exhibits 4, 5, and 7, I think they are. I may have the numbers wrong. But the two guns that are listed is automatics. I think 32, caliber 38 automatic pistol. I mean, it makes no sense. There's only one gun that's listed as a semi-automatic. My guess is that somehow that it was implanted in the mind of the prosecutors that the only 45, the only semi-automatic was that 45 from the exhibit list. And obviously it wasn't. There were four semi-automatic weapons. The court has no further questions. I thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Horst. So, Ms. Kiernan, your time had expired, but you can have another minute if you'd like. Or someone else, okay. Mr. Levinson.
May May it please the Court, Jules Levinson on behalf of Appellant Charles Pollack. Judge Tinder, I'd like to address the question you had earlier about the resentencing with respect to Count 1 and Count 2. The cross-reference would not have been supported by the ammunition possession, so therefore, if the Count 1 were reversed, that would be harm to Pollack, and the sentence would not be the same because the guidelines would be different. And secondly, all of the procedural errors that were made at sentencing would affect the guidelines calculation. So that would require, as this court has held in United States versus Rushton, resentencing from scratch, not just speculation as to what the district court might have done had it not made those errors. I'd also like to point out, as the government acknowledged, it waived both kidnapping and the relevant conduct argument, so therefore this court should not affirm on those bases. And finally, to respond again to you, Judge Tinder, the 45 mentioned by the prosecution in its misconduct tied everything together. There was no evidence. The evidence at trial only showed that Pollack might have possessed something. It didn't speak to whether or not Pollack possessed anything specific, and the prosecution, realizing that that would be an issue, tried to tie together the holes in its evidence and the gaps that it had. Accordingly, we would ask that this court reverse and remand both the sentence and the conviction.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Levinson, Mr. Kiernan, Ms. Kiernan, and Mr. Hosmer. And you, of course, were appointed, so we thank you and the other members of the Bloom Institute for their program.